Side 5. Good Omens. The Nice and Accurate Prophecies of Agnes Nutter, Witch, by Neil Gaiman and Terry Pratchett. Continuing on page 154. They claim to lead the largest coven in Saffron Walden, and to restore sexual potency by the use of small and very phallic dolls. The newspaper was offering 10 of the dolls to readers who were prepared to write "My Most Embarrassing Moment of Impotency" stories. Newt cut the story out and stuck it into a scrapbook. There was a muffled thumping on the door. Newt opened it. A pile of newspapers stood there.
"Shift yourself, Private Pulsifer," it barked, and it shuffled into the room.
The newspapers fell to the floor, revealing Witchfinder Sergeant Shadwell, who coughed painfully and relit his cigarette, which had gone out.
"You want to watch him. He's one of them," he said.
"Who, sir?"
"Tuck your ease, Private. Him. That little brown feller. Mr. So-called Rajit. It's them terrible foreign arts. The ruby squinty eye of the little yellow god. Women with too many arms. Witches, the lot of them."
"He does give us the newspapers free, though, Sergeant," said Newt. "And they're not too old."
"And voodoo. I bet he does voodoo. Sacrificing chickens to that barren Saturday. You know, tall, darky bugger in the top hat. Brings people back from the dead, aye, and makes them work on the Sabbath day. Voodoo."
Shadwell sniffed speculatively. Newt tried to picture Shadwell's landlord as an exponent of voodoo. Certainly Mr. Rajit worked on the Sabbath. In fact, with his plump, quiet wife and plump, cheerful children, he worked around the clock, never mind the calendar, diligently filling the area's needs in the matter of soft drinks, white bread, tobacco, sweets, newspapers, magazines, and the type of top-shelf pornography that made Newt's eyes water just to think about. The worst you could imagine Mr. Rajit doing with a chicken was selling it after the sell-by date.
"But Mr. Rajit's from Bangladesh or India or somewhere," he said. "I thought voodoo came from the West Indies."
"Ah," said Witchfinder Sergeant Shadwell, and took another drag on his cigarette. Or appeared to. Newt had never actually quite seen one of his superior's cigarettes. It was something to do with the way he cupped his hands. He even made the ends disappear when he'd finished with them.
"Ah.
Well, doesn't it?"
"Hidden wisdom, lad. Inner military secrets of the Witchfinder Army. When you're all initiated proper, you'll know the secret truth. Some voodoo may come from the West Indies. I'll grant you that. Oh, yes, I'll grant you that. But the worst kind, the darkest kind, that comes from,
Bangladesh?
Rock! Yes, lad, that's it. Words right out of me mouth. Bangladesh. Exactly."
Shadwell made the end of his cigarette vanish, and managed furtively to roll another, never letting papers or tobacco be seen.
"So, you got anything, Witchfinder Private?"
"Well, there's this." Newton held out the clipping. Shadwell squinted at it.
"Oh, them," he said. "Load of rubbish. Call themselves bloody witches. I checked them out last year. Went down with me armory of righteousness and a packet of firelighters. Jimmied the place open. They were clean as a whistle. Meal order bee jelly business they're trying to pep up. Load of rubbish. Wouldn't know a familiar spirit if it chewed out the bottoms of their trousers. Rubbish. It's not like it used to be, laddie."
He sat down and poured himself a cup of sweet tea from a filthy thermos.
"Did I ever tell you how I was recruited to the army?" he asked.
Newt took this as his cue to sit down. He shook his head. Shadwell lit his roll-up with a battered Ronson lighter and coughed appreciatively.
My cellmate he was. Witchfinder Captain Folks. 10 years for arson. Burning a coven in Wimbledon. Would have got them all, too, if it wasn't the wrong day. Good fellow. Told me about the battle. The great war between heaven and hell. It was him that told me the inner secrets of the Witchfinder army. Familiar spirits, nipples, all that. Knew he was dying, you see. Got to have someone to carry on the tradition, like you is now.
He shook his head.
That's what we'm reduced to, lad, he said. A few hundred years ago, see, we was powerful. We stood between the world and the darkness. We was the thin red line. Thin red line of fire, you see.
I thought the churches, Newt began.
Ha! Said Shadwell.
Newt had seen the word in print, but this was the first time he'd ever heard anyone say it.
Churches. What good did they ever do? They'm just as bad. Same line of business, nearly. You can't trust them to stamp out the evil one, 'cause if they did, they'd be out of that line of business. If you're going up against a tiger, you don't want fellow travelers whose idea of hunting is to throw meat at it. Nay, lad, it's up to us, against the darkness.
Everything went quiet for a moment. Newt always tried to see the best in everyone, but it had occurred to him shortly after joining the WA that his superior and only fellow soldier was as well-balanced as an upturned pyramid. Shortly, in this case, meant under 5 seconds. The WA's headquarters was a fetid room with walls the color of nicotine, which was almost certainly what they were coated with, and a floor the color of cigarette ash, which was almost certainly what it was. There was a small square of carpet. Newt avoided walking on it if possible, because it sucked at his shoes. One of the walls had a yellowing map of the British Isles tacked to it, with homemade flags sticking in it here and there. Most of them were within a cheap day return fare of London. But Newt had stuck with it the past few weeks because, well, horrified fascination had turned into horrified pity, and then a sort of horrified affection. Shadwell had turned out to be about 5 feet high, and wore clothes which, no matter what they actually were, always turned up, even in your short-term memory, as an old Macintosh. The old man may have had all his own teeth, but only because no one else could possibly have wanted them. Just one of them, placed under the pillow, would have made the tooth fairy hand in its wand. He appeared to live entirely on sweet tea, condensed milk, hand-rolled cigarettes, and a sort of sullen internal energy. Shadwell had a cause, which he followed with the full resources of his soul and his pensioner's concessionary travel pass. He believed in it. It powered him like a turbine. Newton Pulsifer had never had a cause in his life, nor had he, as far as he knew, ever believed in anything. It had been embarrassing because he quite wanted to believe in something, since he recognized that belief was the life belt that got most people through the choppy waters of life. He'd have liked to believe in a supreme God, although he'd have preferred a half-hour's chat with him before committing himself to clear up one or two points. He'd sat in all sorts of churches, waiting for that single flash of blue light, and it hadn't come. And then he'd tried to become an official atheist, and hadn't got the rock-hard, self-satisfied strength of belief even for that. And every single political party had seemed to him equally dishonest. And he'd given up on ecology when the ecology magazine he'd been subscribing to had shown his readers a plan of a self-sufficient garden, and had drawn the ecological goat tethered within 3 feet of the ecological beehive. Newt had spent a lot of time at his grandmother's house in the country, and thought he knew something about the habits of both goats and bees, and concluded, therefore, that the magazine was run by a bunch of bib-overalled maniacs. Besides, it used the word community too often. Newt had always suspected that people who regularly used the word community were using it in a very specific sense that excluded him and everyone he knew. Then he'd tried believing in the universe, which seemed sound enough, until he'd innocently started reading new books with words like chaos and time and quantum in the titles. He'd found that even the people whose job of work was, so to speak, the universe, didn't really believe in it, and were actually quite proud of not knowing what it really was, or even if it could theoretically exist. To Newt's straightforward mind, this was intolerable. Newt had not believed in the Cub Scouts, and then, when he was old enough, not in the Scouts either. He was prepared to believe, though, that the job of wages clerk at United Holdings, PLC, was possibly the most boring in the world. This is how Newton Pulsifer looked as a man. If he went into a phone booth and changed, he might manage to come out looking like Clark Kent. But he found he rather liked Shadwell. People often did, much to Shadwell's annoyance. The Rajits liked him because he always eventually paid his rent and didn't cause any trouble, and was racist in such a glowering, undirected way that it was quite inoffensive. It was simply that Shadwell hated everyone in the world, regardless of caste, color, or creed, and wasn't going to make any exceptions for anyone. Madam Tracy liked him. Newt had been amazed to find that the tenant of the other flat was a middle-aged, motherly soul, whose gentleman callers called as much for a cup of tea and a nice chat as for what little discipline she was still able to exact. Sometimes, when he'd nursed a half-pint of Guinness on a Saturday night, Shadwell would stand in the corridor between their rooms and shout things like, "Whore of Babylon!" But she told Newt privately that she'd always felt rather gratified about this, even though the closest she'd been to Babylon was Torremolinos. It was like free advertising, she said. She said she didn't mind him banging on the wall and swearing during her seance afternoons either. Her knees had been giving her jip, and she wasn't always up to operating the table wrapper, she said. So a bit of muffled thumping came in useful. On Sundays, she'd leave him a bit of dinner on his doorstep, with another plate over the top of it to keep it warm. You couldn't help liking Shadwell, she said. For all the good it did, though, she might as well be flicking bread pellets into a black hole. Newt remembered the other cuttings. He pushed them across the stained desk.
"What are these?" said Shadwell suspiciously.
"Phenomena," said Newt. "You said to look for phenomena. There's more phenomena than witches these days, I'm afraid."
"Anyone been shooting hares with a silver bullet, and next day an old clone in the village is walking with a limp?" Shadwell said hopefully.
"I am afraid not."
"Any cows dropping dead after some woman has looked at 'em?"
"No."
"What is it, then?" said Shadwell.
He shuffled across to the sticky brown cupboard and pulled out a tin of condensed milk. "Odd things happening," said Newt. He'd spent weeks on this. Shadwell had really let the papers pile up. Some of them went back for years. Newt had quite a good memory, perhaps because in his 26 years very little had happened to fill it up, and he had become quite expert on some very esoteric subjects. "Seems to be something new every day," said Newt, flicking through the rectangles of newsprint. something weird has been happening to nuclear power stations, and no one seems to know what it is. And some people are claiming that the lost continent of Atlantis has risen. He looked proud of his efforts. Shadwell's penknife punctured the condensed milk tin. There was the distant sound of a telephone ringing. Both men instinctively ignored it. All the calls were from Madame Tracy anyway, and some of them were not intended for the ear of man. Newt had conscientiously answered the phone on his first day, listened carefully to the question, said, "Marks and Spencer's 100% cotton Y-fronts, actually," and had been left with a dead receiver. Shadwell sucked deeply. "Ah, that's not proper phenomena," he said. "Can't see any witches doing that. They're more for the sinking of things, you ken." Newt's mouth opened and shut a few times. "If we're strong in the fight against witchery, we can't afford to be sidetracked by this style of thing," Shadwell went on. "Haven't you got anything more witchcrafty?"
"But American troops have landed on it to protect it from things," moaned Newt. "A non-existent continent."
"Any witches on it?"
said Shadwell, showing a spark of interest for the first time.
"It doesn't say," said Newt.
"Ach, then it's just politics and geography," said Shadwell dismissively.
Madame Tracy poked her head around the door.
"Coo-wee, Mr. Shadwell," she said, giving Newt a friendly little wave. "A gentleman on the telephone for you. Hello, Mr. Newton."
"Away wi' ye, harlot,"
said Shadwell automatically.
"He sounds ever so refined," said Madame Tracy, taking no notice. "And I'll be getting us a nice bit of liver for Sunday."
"I'd sooner sup wi' a dead old woman."
"So if you'd let me have the plates back from last week, it'd be a help, there's a love," said Madame Tracy,
and tottered unsteadily back on 3-inch heels to her flat, and whatever it was that had been interrupted. Newt looked despondently at his cuttings as Shadwell went out, rumbling to the phone. There was one about the stones of Stonehenge moving out of position, as though they were iron filings in a magnetic field. He was vaguely aware of one side of a telephone conversation.
"Who? Ah, I. You say, what class of thing would that be? I. Just as you say, sir. And where is this place, then?"
But mysteriously moving stones wasn't Shadwell's cup of tea, or rather tin of milk.
"Fine, fine," Shadwell reassured the caller. "We'll get on to it right away. I'll put my best squad on it and report success to ye at any minute. I had no doubt. Goodbye to you, sir. And bless you too, sir."
There was the ting of a receiver going back on the hook, and then Shadwell's voice, no longer metaphorically crouched in deference, said,
"Dear boy, you great southern pansy."
Note: Shadwell hated all southerners, and by inference, was standing at the North Pole. End note. He shuffled back into the room, and then stared at Newt, as if he had forgotten why he was there.
"What was it ye was going on about?" he said.
"All these things that are happening," Newt began.
"Aye."
Shadwell continued to look through him while thoughtfully tapping the empty tin against his teeth.
"Well, there is this little town which has been having some amazing weather for the last few years," Newt went on helplessly.
"What? Raining frogs and similar?" said Shadwell, brightening up a bit.
"No, it just has normal weather for the time of year."
"Call that a phenomena?" said Shadwell. "I've seen phenomenas that'd make your hair curl, laddie."
He started tapping again.
"When do you remember normal weather for the time of year?" said Newt, slightly annoyed.
Normal weather for the time of year isn't normal, Sergeant. It has snow at Christmas. When did you last see snow at Christmas? And long, hot Augusts? Every year? And crisp autumns? The kind of weather you used to dream of as a kid? It never rained on November the 5th and always snowed on Christmas Eve? Shadwell's eyes looked unfocused. He paused with a condensed milk tin halfway to his lips.
I never used to dream when I was a kid, he said quietly.
Newt was aware of skidding around the lip of some deep, unpleasant pit. He mentally backed away. It's just very odd, he said. There's a weatherman here talking about averages and norms and microclimates and things like that.
What's that mean? Said Shadwell.
Means he doesn't know why, said Newt, who hadn't spent years on the literal of business without picking up a thing or two. He looked sidelong at the witchfinder sergeant. Witches are well known for affecting the weather, he prompted. I looked it up in the Discovery. Oh, God, he thought, or other suitable entity, don't let me spend another evening cutting newspapers to bits in this ashtray of a room. Let me get out in the fresh air. Let me do whatever is the WA's equivalent of going water skiing in Germany. It's only 40 miles away, he said tentatively. I thought I could just sort of nip over there tomorrow and have a look around, you know. I'll pay my own petrol, he added. Shadwell wiped his upper lip thoughtfully.
This place, he said, it wouldn't have been called Tadfield, would it?
That's right, Mr. Shadwell, said Newt. How did you know that?
Wonder what the Southerners is playing at now, said Shadwell under his breath. Well, he said out loud, and why not?
Who'll be playing, Sergeant? Said Newt. Shadwell ignored him.
I suppose it can't do any harm. You'll pay your ain petrol, you say?
Newt nodded.
Then you'll come here at 9 o'clock in the morning, he said, afore you go.
What for? Said Newt.
Your armor of righteousness.
Just after Newt had left, the phone rang again. This time it was Crowley, who gave approximately the same instructions as Aziraphale. Shadwell took them down again for form's sake, while Madam Tracy hovered delightedly behind him. 2 calls in 1 day, Mr. Shadwell, she said. Your little army must be marching away like anything.
Ach, away with ye, ye moraine-plashed Berezine,
muttered Shadwell, and slammed the door. Tadfield, he thought.
Ach, weel.
So long as they paid up on time. Neither Aziraphale or Crowley ran the Witchfinder army, but they both approved of it, or at least knew that it would be approved of by their superiors. So it appeared on the list of Aziraphale's agencies because it was, well, a Witchfinder army, and you had to support anyone calling themselves witchfinders in the same way that the USA had to support anyone calling themselves anti-communist. And it appeared on Crowley's list for the slightly more sophisticated reason that people like Shadwell did the cause of hell no harm at all. Quite the reverse, it was felt. Strictly speaking, Shadwell didn't run the WA either. According to Shadwell's pay ledgers, it was run by Witchfinder General Smith. Under him were Witchfinder Colonels Green and Jones, and Witchfinder Majors Jackson, Robinson, and Smith. No relation. Then there were Witchfinder Majors Saucepan, Tin, Milk, and Cupboard, because Shadwell's limited imagination had been beginning to struggle at this point. And Witchfinder Captains Smith, and Smythe, and Ditto. And 500 Witchfinder privates and corporals and sergeants. Many of them were called Smith, But this didn't matter because neither Crowley nor Azrafael had ever bothered to read that far. They simply handed over the pay. After all, both lots put together only came to around £60 a year. Shadwell didn't consider this in any way criminal. The army was a sacred trust, and a man had to do something. The old ninepences weren't coming in like they used to. Saturday. It was very early on Saturday morning, on the last day of the world, and the sky was redder than blood. The International Express delivery man rounded the corner at a careful 35 miles an hour, shifted down to second, and pulled up on the grass verge. He got out of the van and immediately threw himself into a ditch to avoid an oncoming lorry that had barreled around the bend at something well in excess of 80 miles an hour. He got up, picked up his glasses, put them back on, retrieved his parcel and clipboard, brushed the grass and mud from his uniform, and, as an afterthought, shook his fist at the rapidly diminishing lorry. "Shouldn't be allowed, bloody lorries. No respect for other road users. What I always say is, remember that without a car, son, you're just a pedestrian, too." He climbed down the grassy verge, clambered over a low fence, and found himself beside the River Uck. The International Express delivery man walked along the banks of the river, holding the parcel. Farther down the riverbank sat a young man dressed all in white. He was the only person in sight. His hair was white, his skin chalk pale, and he sat and stared up and down the river as if he were admiring the view. He looked like Victorian romantic poets looked just before the consumption and drug abuse really started to cut it. The International Express man couldn't understand it. I mean, in the old days, and it wasn't that long ago, really, there had been an angler every dozen yards along the bank. Children had played there. Courting couples had come to listen to the splish and gurgle of the river, and to hold hands, and to get all lovey-dovey in the Sussex sunset. He'd done that with Maud, his missus, before they were married. They'd come here to spoon, and on one memorable occasion, fork. Times changed, reflected the delivery man. Now white and brown sculptures of foam and sludge drifted serenely down the river, often covering it for yards at a stretch, and where the surface of the water was visible, it was covered with a molecules-thin petrochemical sheen. There was a loud whirring as a couple of geese, thankful to be back in England again after the long, exhausting flight across the northern Atlantic, landed on the rainbow-slicked water, and sank without trace. Funny old world, thought the delivery man. Here's the Uck, used to be the prettiest river in this part of the world, and now it's just a glorified industrial sewer. The swans sink to the bottom, and the fishes float on the top. Well, that's progress for you. You can't stop progress. He had reached the man in white. "Excuse me, sir. Party name of Chalky?" The man in white nodded, said nothing. He continued to gaze out at the river, following an impressive sludge and foam sculpture with his eyes. "So beautiful," he whispered. "It's all so damn beautiful." The delivery man found himself temporarily devoid of words. Then his automatic systems cut in. "Funny old world, isn't it? And no mistake, I mean, you go all over the world delivering, and then here you are practically in your own home, so to speak. I mean, I was born and bred round here, sir, and I've been to the Mediterranean, and to Des Moines, and that's in America, sir. And now here I am, and here's your parcel, sir." Party name of Chalky took the parcel, and took the clipboard, and signed for the parcel. The pen developed a leak as he did so, and his signature obliterated itself as it was written. It was a long word, and it began with a P. And then there was a splodge, and then it ended in something that might have been ence, and might have been ocean. "Much obliged, sir," said the delivery man. He walked back along the river, back toward the busy road where he had left his van, trying not to look at the river as he went. Behind him, the man in white opened the parcel. In it was a crown, a circlet of white metal, set with diamonds. He gazed at it for some seconds, with satisfaction, then put it on. It glinted in the light of the rising sun. Then the tarnish, which had begun to suffuse its silver surface when his fingers touched it, spread to cover it completely, and the crown went black. White stood up. There's one thing you can say for air pollution. You get utterly amazing sunrises. It looked like someone had set fire to the sky. And a careless match would have set fire to the river. But, alas, there was no time for that now. In his mind, he knew where the four of them would be meeting, and when. And he was going to have to hurry to be there by this afternoon. Perhaps we will set fire to the sky, he thought. And he left that place, almost imperceptibly. It was nearly time. The delivery man had left his van on the grass verge by the dual carriageway. He walked around to the driver's side, carefully, because other cars and lorries were still rocketing around the bend, reached in through the open window, and took the schedule from the dashboard. Only one more delivery to make, then. He read the instructions on the delivery voucher carefully. He read them again, paying particular attention to the address and the message. The address was one word. Everywhere. Then, with his leaking pen, he wrote a brief note to Maud, his wife. It read simply, I love you. Then he put the schedule back on the dashboard, looked left, looked right, looked left again, and began to walk purposefully across the road. He was halfway across when a German juggernaut came around the corner, its driver crazed on caffeine, little white pills, and EEC transport regulations. He watched its receding bulk. Car, he thought. That one nearly had me. Then he looked down at the gutter. Oh, he thought. Yes, agreed a voice from behind his left shoulder, or at least from behind the memory of his left shoulder. The delivery man turned and looked and saw. At first he couldn't find the words, couldn't find anything. And then the habits of a working lifetime took over, and he said, Message for you, sir? For me? Yes, sir. He wished he still had a throat. He could have swallowed if he still had a throat. No package, I'm afraid, mister. Sir? It's a message. Deliver it, then. It's this, sir. Come and see. Finally. There was a grin on its face. But then, given the face, there couldn't have been anything else. Thank you, it continued. I must commend your devotion to duty. Sir? The late delivery man was falling through a gray mist, and all he could see were two spots of blue that might have been eyes and might have been distant stars. Don't think of it as dying, said Death. Just think of it as leaving early to avoid the rush. The delivery man had a brief moment to wonder whether his new companion was making a joke, and to decide that he wasn't. And then there was nothing. Red sky in the morning. It was going to rain. Yes. Witchfinder Sergeant Shadwell stood back with his head on one side. Right then, he said. You're all ready. Hey, you got it all?
Yes, sir.
Pendulum of Discovery?
Pendulum of Discovery, yes.
Thumbscrew?
Newt swallowed and patted a pocket.
Thumbscrew, he said.
Firelighters?
I really think, Sergeant, that
Firelighters?
Firelighters. Note. Note for Americans and other city-dwelling life forms. The rural British, having eschewed central heating as being far too complicated, and in any case weakening moral fiber, prefer a system of piling small pieces of wood and lumps of coal, topped by large wet logs, possibly made of asbestos, into small, smoldering heaps, known as, "There's nothing like a roaring open fire, is there?" Since none of these ingredients are naturally inclined to burn, underneath all this, they apply a small, rectangular, waxy white lump, which burns cheerfully until the weight of the fire puts it out. These little white blocks are called firelighters. No one knows why. End note. Said Newt sadly.
And matches. Bell, book, and candle.
Newt patted another pocket. It contained a paper bag inside which was a small bell, of the sort that maddens budgerigars, a pink candle of the birthday cake persuasion, and a tiny book called Prayers for Little Hands. Shadwell had impressed upon him that, although witches were the primary target, a good witch finder should never pass up the chance to do a quick exorcism, and should have his field kit with him at all times.
Bell, book, and candle, said Newt.
Pin?
Pin.
Good lad. Never forget your pin. It's the bayonet in your artillery alight.
Shadwell stood back. Newt noticed with amazement that the old man's eyes had misted over.
I wish I was going with ye, he said. Of course, this won't be anything, but it'd be good to get out and about again. It's a trying life, ye ken. All this lying in the wet bracken, spying on the devilish dancing. It gets into your bones something cruel.
He straightened up and saluted.
Off ye go, then, Private Pulsifer. May the armies of glorification march with ye.
After Newt had driven off, Shadwell thought of something. Something that he'd never had the chance to do before. What he needed now was a pin. Not a military issue pin. Witches for the use of. Just an ordinary pin. Such as you might stick in a map. The map was on the wall. It was old. It didn't show Milton Keynes. It didn't show Harlow. It barely showed Manchester and Birmingham. It had been the Army's HQ map for 300 years. There were a few pins in it still, mainly in Yorkshire and Lancashire, and a few in Essex. But they were almost rusted through. Elsewhere, mere brown stubs indicated the distant mission of a long-ago witch-finder. Shadwell finally found a pin among the debris in an ashtray. He breathed on it, polished it to his shine, squinted at the map until he located Tadfield, and triumphantly rammed the pin home. It gleamed. Shadwell took a step backward and saluted again. There were tears in his eyes. Then he did a smart about turn and saluted the display cabinet. It was old and battered, and the glass was broken. But in a way, it was the WA. It contained the regimental silver, the inter-battalion golf trophy, not competed for, alas, in 70 years. It contained the patent muzzle-loading thunder gun of Witchfinder Colonel Ye Shall Not Eat Any Living Thing With The Blood, Neither Shall Ye Use Enchantment Nor Observe Times, Dalrymple. It contained a display of what were apparently walnuts, but were in reality a collection of shrunken headhunter heads donated by Witchfinder C.S.M. Horace, Get Them Afore They Get You, Narker, who'd traveled widely in foreign parts. It contained memories. Shadwell blew his nose noisily on his sleeve. Then he opened a tin of condensed milk for breakfast. If the armies of glorification had tried to march with Newt, bits of them would have dropped off. This is because, apart from Newt and Shadwell, they had been dead for quite a long time. It was a mistake to think of Shadwell. Newt never found out if he had a first name. As a lone nut. It was just that all the others were dead, in most cases for several hundred years. Once the army had been as big as it currently appeared in Shadwell's creatively edited bookkeeping. Newt had been surprised to find that the Witchfinder army had antecedents as long and almost as bloody as its more mundane counterpart. The rates of pay for Witchfinders had last been set by Oliver Cromwell, and never reviewed. Officers got a crown, and the general got a sovereign. It was just an honorarium, of course, because you got 9 pence per witch found and first pick of their property. You really got to rely on those 9 pences. And so times had been a bit hard before Shadwell had gone on the payrolls of heaven and hell. Newt's pay was 1 old shilling per year. Note. Note for young people and Americans. 1 shilling equals 5p. It helps to understand the antique finances of the Witchfinder Army if you know the original British monetary system. 2 farthings equal 1 halfpenny. 2 halfpennies equal 1 penny. 3 pennies, a threepenny bit. 2 threepences equal a 6 pence. 2 6 pences equal 1 shilling, or bob. 2 bob equal a florin. 1 florin and 1 6 pence equal 1/2 crown. 4 half crowns equal 10 bob note. 2 10-bob notes equal 1 pound, or 240 pennies. 1 pound and 1 shilling equal 1 guinea. The British resisted decimalized currency for a long time because they thought it was too complicated. End note. In return for this, he was charged to keep glimmer, firelock, firebox, tinderbox, or igniferous matches about his person at all times, although Shadwell indicated that a Ronson gas lighter would do very well. Shadwell had accepted the invention of the patent cigarette lighter in the same way that conventional soldiers welcomed the repeating rifle. The way Newt looked at it, it was like being in one of those organizations like the Sealed Knot, or those people who kept on refighting the American Civil War. It got you out at weekends, and meant that you were keeping alive fine old traditions that had made Western civilization what it was today. An hour after leaving the headquarters, Newt pulled into a lay-by and rummaged in the box on the passenger seat. Then he opened the car window, using a pair of pliers for the purpose, since the handle had long since fallen off. The packet of firelighters was sent winging over the hedge. A moment later, the thumbscrew followed it. He debated about the rest of the stuff, and then put it back in the box. The pin was Witchfinder military issue, with a good ebony knob on the end, like a lady's hatpin. He knew what it was for. He'd done quite a lot of reading. Shadwell had piled him up with pamphlets at their first meeting, but the army had also accumulated various books and documents which, Newt suspected, would be worth a fortune if they ever hit the market. The pin was to jab into suspects. If there was a spot on their body where they didn't feel anything, they were a witch. Simple. Some of the fraudulent witch finders had used special retracting pins, but this one was honest, solid steel. He wouldn't be able to look old Shadwell in the face if he threw away the pin. Besides, it was probably bad luck. He started the engine and resumed his journey. Newt's car was a wasabi. He called it Dick Turpin, in the hope that one day someone would ask him why. It would be a very accurate historian who could pinpoint the precise day when the Japanese changed from being fiendish automatons who copied everything from the West, to becoming skilled and cunning engineers who would leave the West standing. But the wasabi had been designed on that one confused day, and combine the traditional bad points of most Western cars with a host of innovative disasters, the avoidance of which had made firms like Honda and Toyota what they were today. Newt had never actually seen another one on the road, despite his best efforts. For years, and without much conviction, he'd enthused to his friends about its economy and efficiency in the desperate hope that one of them might buy one, because misery loves company. In vain did he point out its 823cc engine, its three-speed gearbox, its incredible safety devices, like the balloons which inflated on dangerous occasions, such as when you were doing 45 mph on a straight, dry road, but were about to crash because a huge safety balloon had just obscured the view. He'd also waxed slightly lyrical about the Korean-made radio, which picked up Radio Pyongyang incredibly well, and the simulated electronic voice which warned you about not wearing a seatbelt, even when you were. It had been programmed by someone who not only didn't understand English, but didn't understand Japanese either. It was state-of-the-art, he said. The art in this case was probably pottery. His friends nodded and agreed and privately decided that if ever it came to buying a wasabi or walking, they'd invest in a pair of shoes. It came to the same thing anyway, since one reason for the wasabi's incredible MPG was that fact that it spent a lot of time waiting in garages while crankshafts and things were in the post from the world's only surviving wasabi agent in Nigirizushi, Japan. In that vague, zen-like trance in which most people drive, Newt found himself wondering exactly how you used the pen. Did you say, "I've got a pen, and I'm not afraid to use it"? Have pen will travel. The pen slinger. The man with a golden pin. The pins of Navarone. It might have interested Newt to know that of the 39,000 women tested with a pin during the centuries of witch hunting, 29,000 said ouch. 9,999 didn't feel anything because of the use of the aforesaid retractable pins. And one witch declared that it had miraculously cleared up the arthritis in her leg. Her name was Agnes Nutter. She was the Witchfinder Army's great failure. One of the early entries in the Nice and Accurate Prophecies concerned Agnes Nutter's own death. The English, by and large, being a crass and indolent race, were not as keen on burning women as other countries in Europe. In Germany, the bonfires were built and burned with regular Teutonic thoroughness. Even the pious Scots, locked throughout history in a long, drawn-out battle with their archenemies, the Scots, managed a few burnings to while away the long winter evenings. But the English never seemed to have the heart for it. One reason for this may have to do with the manner of Agnes Nutter's death, which more or less marked the end of the serious witch-hunting craze in England. A howling mob, reduced to utter fury by her habit of going around being intelligent and curing people, arrived at her house one April evening to find her sitting with her coat on, waiting for them. "You're tardy," she said to them. "I should have been aflame 10 minutes since." Then she got up and hobbled slowly through the suddenly silent crowd, out of the cottage, and to the bonfire that had been hastily thrown together on the village green. Legend says that she climbed awkwardly onto the pyre and thrust her arms around the stake behind her. "Tie it well," she said to the astonished witchfinder. And then, as the villagers sidled toward the pyre, she raised her handsome head in the firelight and said, "Gather ye right close, good people. Come close until the fire near scorch ye, for I charge ye that all must see how the last true witch in England dies. For which I am, for so I am judged, yet I know not what my true crime may be. And therefore let mine death
be a message to the world. Gather ye right close, I say, and mark well the fate of all who meddle with such as they do not understand.
And apparently she smiled and looked up at the sky over the village and added,
That goes for you as well, you daft old fool.
And after that strange blasphemy, she said no more. She let them gag her and stood imperiously as the torches were put to the dry wood. The crowd grew nearer. One or two of its members, a little uncertain as to whether they'd done the right thing, now they came to think about it. 30 seconds later, an explosion took out the village green, scythed the valley clean of every living thing, and was seen as far away as Halifax. There was much subsequent debate as to whether this had been sent by God or by Satan, but a note later found in Agnes Nutter's cottage indicated that any divine or devilish intervention had been materially helped by the contents of Agnes's petticoats, wherein she had, with some foresight, concealed 80 pounds of gunpowder and 40 pounds of roofing nails. What Agnes also left behind, on the kitchen table beside a note canceling the milk, was a box and a book. There were specific instructions as to what should be done with the box, and equally specific instructions about what should be done with the book. It was to be sent to Agnes's son, John Device. The people who found it, who were from the next village and had been woken up by the explosion, considered ignoring the instructions and just burning the cottage, and then looked around at the twinkling fires and nail-studded wreckage and decided not to. Besides, Agnes's note included painfully precise predictions about what would happen to people who did not carry out her orders. The man who put the torch to Agnes Nutter was a witch-finder major. They found his hat in a tree 2 miles away. His name, stitched inside on a fairly large piece of tape, was Thou Shalt Not Commit Adultery, Pulsifer, one of England's most assiduous witch-finders, and it might have afforded him some satisfaction to know that his last surviving descendant was now, even if unawares, heading toward Agnes Nutter's last surviving descendant. He might have felt that some ancient revenge was at last going to be discharged. If he'd known what was actually going to happen when that descendant met her, he would have turned in his grave, except that he had never got one. Firstly, however, Newt had to do something about the flying saucer. It landed in the road ahead of him, just as he was trying to find the lower Tadfield turning, and had the map spread over the steering wheel. He had to brake hard. It looked like every cartoon of a flying saucer Newt had ever seen. As he stared over the top of his map, a door in the saucer slid aside with a satisfying whoosh, revealing a gleaming walkway, which extended automatically down to the road. Brilliant blue light shone out, outlining 3 alien shapes. They walked down the ramp. At least 2 of them walked. The one that looked like a pepper pot just skidded down it and fell over at the bottom. The other 2 ignored its frantic beeping and walked over to the car quite slowly, in the worldwide approved manner of policemen already compiling the charge sheet in their heads. The tallest one, a yellow toad dressed in kitchen foil, rapped on Newt's window. He wound it down. The thing was wearing the kind of mirror-finished sunglasses that Newt always thought of as Cool Hand Luke shades.
"Morning, sir, or madam, or neuter," the thing said. "This your planet, is it?"
The other alien, which was stubby and green, had wandered off into the woods by the side of the road. Out of the corner of his eye, Newt saw it kick a tree, and then run a leaf through some complicated gadget on its belt. It didn't look very pleased.
"Well, yes, I suppose so," he said.
The toad stared thoughtfully at the skyline.
"Had it long, have we, sir?"
it said.
Not personally. I mean, as a species, about 500,000 years, I think.
The alien exchanged glances with his colleague. "Been letting the old acid rain build up, haven't we, sir?" it said. "Been letting ourselves go a bit with the old hydrocarbons, perhaps."
"I'm sorry?"
"Could you tell me your planet's albedo, sir?" said the toad, still staring levelly at the horizon as though it was doing something interesting.
No.
"Well, I'm sorry to have to tell you, sir, that your polar ice caps are below regulation size for a planet of this category, sir."
"Oh, dear," said Newt. He was wondering who he could tell about this,
and realizing that there was absolutely no one who would believe him. The toad bent closer. It seemed to be worried about something, insofar as Newt was any judge of the expressions of an alien race he'd never encountered before.
"We'll overlook it on this occasion, sir," Newt gabbled.
I'll see to it. Well, when I say I mean... I think Antarctica or something belongs to every country or something, and...
"The fact is, sir, that we have been asked to give you a message."
"Oh?"
"Message runs, we give you a message of universal peace and cosmic harmony and such like." "Message ends," said the toad.
"Oh."
Newt turned this over in his mind.
"Oh, that's very kind."
"Have you got any idea why we have been asked to bring you this message, sir?" said the toad. Newt brightened.
"Well, I suppose," he flailed, "what with mankind's, harnessing of the atom and..."
"Neither have we, sir." The toad stood up. "One of them phenomena, I expect. Well, we'd better be going."
It shook its head vaguely, turned around, and waddled back to the saucer without another word. Newt stuck his head out of the window.
"Thank you."
The small alien walked past the car.
CO2 level up 0.5%.
It rasped, giving him a meaningful look.
"You do know you could find yourself charged with being a dominant species while under the influence of impulse-driven consumerism, don't you?"
The two of them righted the third alien, dragged it back up the ramp, and shut the door. Newt waited for a while, in case there were any spectacular light displays, but it just stood there. Eventually, he drove up on the verge and around it. When he looked in his rearview mirror, it had gone. "I must be overdoing something," he thought guiltily. "But what?" "And I can't even tell Shadwell, because he'd probably bawl me out for not counting their nipples."
"Anyway," said Adam, "you've got it all wrong about witches."
The them were sitting on a field gate, watching dog rolling and cowpats. The little mongrel seemed to be enjoying himself immensely.
"I've been reading about them," he said in a slightly louder voice. "Actually, they've been right all along, and it's wrong to persecute 'em with British Inquisitions and stuff. My mother said they were just intelligent women protesting in the only way open to them against the stifling injustices of a male-dominated social hierarchy," said Pepper.
Pepper's mother lectured at Norton Polytechnic.
Note, during the day. In the evenings, she gave power tarot readings to nervous executives, because old habits die hard. End note.
"Yes, but your mother's always saying things like that," said Adam after a while.
Pepper nodded amiably.
"And she said, at worst, they were just free-thinking worshippers of the progenerative principle." "Who's the progenerative principle?" said Wensleydale.
"Dunno. Something to do with Naples, I think, said Pepper vaguely.
Well, I thought they worshipped the devil, said Brian, but without automatic condemnation. The them had an open mind on the whole subject of devil worship. The them had an open mind about everything. Anyway, the devil'd be better than a stupid maypole. That's where you're wrong, said Adam. It's not the devil. It's another god or something with horns. The devil, said Brian. No, said Adam patiently. People just got him mixed up. He's just got horns similar. He's called Pan. He's half a goat. Which half? Said Wensleydale. Adam thought about it. The bottom half, he said at length. Fancy you not knowing that. I should have thought everyone knew that. Goats haven't got a bottom half, said Wensleydale. They've got a front half and a back half, just like cows. They watched dogs some more, drumming their heels on the gate. It was too hot to think. Then Pepper said, If he's got goat legs, he shouldn't have horns. They belong to the front half. I didn't make him up, did I? Said Adam, aggrieved. I was just telling you. It's news to me I made him up. No need to go on at me. Anyway, said Pepper, this stupid pot can't go around complaining if people think he's the devil. Not with having horns on. People are bound to say, Oh, here comes the devil. Dogs started to dig up a rabbit hole. Adam, who seemed to have a weight on his mind, took a deep breath. You don't have to be so literal about everything, he said. That's the trouble these days. Grass materialism. It's people like you who go round chopping down rainforests and making holes in the ozone layer. There's a great big hole in the ozone layer cause of grass materialism people like you. I can't do anything about it, said Brian automatically. I'm still paying off on a stupid cucumber frame. It's in the magazine, said Adam. It takes millions of acres of rainforest to make one beef burger. And all this ozone is leaking away because of, he hesitated, people spraying the environment. And there's whales, said Wensleydale. We've got to save them. Adam looked blank. His plunder of New Aquarian's back issues hadn't included anything about whales. Its editors had assumed that the readers were all for saving whales, in the same way they assumed that those readers breathed and walked upright. There was this program about them, explained Wensleydale. What have we got to save them for? Said Adam. He had confused visions of saving up whales until you had enough for a badge. Wensleydale paused and racked his memory. Because they can sing, and they got big brains. There's hardly any of them left. And we don't need to kill them anyway, cause they only make pet food and stuff. If they're so clever, said Brian slowly, what are they doing in the sea? Oh, I don't know, said Adam, looking thoughtful. Swimming around all day, just opening their mouths and eating stuff. Sounds pretty clever to me. A squeal of brakes and a long, drawn-out crunch interrupted him. They scrambled off the gate and ran up the lane to the crossroads, where a small car lay on its roof at the end of a long skid mark. A little further down the road was a hole. It looked as though the car had tried to avoid it. As they looked at it, a small, oriental-looking head darted out of sight. The them dragged the door open and pulled out the unconscious Newt. Visions of medals for heroic rescue thronged Adam's head. Practical considerations of first aid thronged around that of Wensleydale. We shouldn't move him,
he said, because of broken bones. We ought to get someone. Adam cast around. There was a rooftop just visible in the trees down the road. It was Jasmine Cottage. And in Jasmine Cottage, Anathema Device was sitting in front of a table on which some bandages, aspirins, and assorted first aid items had been laid out for the past hour. Anathema had been looking at the clock. He'll be coming around any moment now, she thought. And then, when he got there, he wasn't what she'd been expecting. More precisely, he wasn't what she'd been hoping for. She had been hoping, rather self-consciously, for someone tall, dark, and handsome. Newt was tall, but with a rolled-out, thin look. And while his hair was undoubtedly dark, it wasn't any sort of fashion accessory. It was just a lot of thin, black strands all growing together out of the top of his head. This was not Newt's fault. In his younger days, he would go every couple of months to the barber shop on the corner, clutching a photograph he'd carefully torn from a magazine, which showed someone with an impressively cool haircut grinning at the camera. And he would show the picture to the barber and ask to be made to look like that, please. And the barber, who knew his job, would take one look and then give Newt the basic, all-purpose short back and sides. After a year of this, Newt realized that he obviously didn't have the face that went with haircuts. The best Newt and Pulsifer could hope for after a haircut was shorter hair. It was the same with suits. The clothing hadn't been invented that would make him look suave and sophisticated and comfortable. These days he had learned to be satisfied with anything that would keep the rain off and give him somewhere to keep his change. And he wasn't handsome. Not even when he took off his glasses. Note, actually, less so when he took off his glasses, because then he tripped over things and wore bandages a lot. End note. And she discovered when she took off his shoes to lay him on her bed, he wore odd socks, one blue one with a hole in the heel, and one gray one with holes around the toes. I suppose I meant to feel a wave of warm, tender, female something or other about this, she thought. I just wish he'd wash them. So, tall, dark, but not handsome. She shrugged. Okay, 2 out of 3 isn't bad. The figure on the bed began to stir, and Anathema, who in the very nature of things always looked to the future, suppressed her disappointment and said, How are we feeling now? Newt opened his eyes. He was lying in a bedroom, and it wasn't his. He knew this instantly because of the ceiling. His bedroom ceiling still had the model aircraft hanging from bits of cotton. He'd never got around to taking them down. This ceiling just had cracked plaster. Newt had never been in a woman's bedroom before, but he sensed that this was won largely by a combination of soft smells. There was a hint of talcum and lily of the valley, and no rank suggestion of old T-shirts that had forgotten what the inside of a tumble dryer looked like. He tried to lift his head up, groaned, and let it sink back onto the pillow. Pink, he couldn't help noticing. You banged your head on the steering wheel, said the voice that had roused him. Nothing broken, though. What happened? Newt opened his eyes again. Car all right? He said. Apparently, a little voice inside it keeps repeating, Please to fasten sleetbert. See, said Newt to an invisible audience. They knew how to build them in those days. That plastic finish hardly takes a dent. He blinked at Anathema. I swerved to avoid a Tibetan in the road, he said. At least, I think I did. I think I've probably gone mad. The figure walked around into his line of sight. It had dark hair and red lips and green eyes, and it was almost certainly female. Newt tried not to stare. It said, "If you have, no one's going to notice." Then she smiled. "Do you know, I've never met a witchfinder before." Newt began. She held up his open wallet. "I had to look inside," she said. Newt felt extremely embarrassed, a not unusual state of affairs. Shadwell had given him an official witchfinder's warrant card, which, among other things, charged all beadles, magistrates, bishops, and bailiffs to give him free passage and as much dry kindling as he required. It was incredibly impressive, a masterpiece of calligraphy, and probably quite old. He'd forgotten about it. "It's really just a hobby," he said wretchedly. "I'm really, He wasn't going to say wages clerk. Not here. Not now. Not to a girl like this. "A computer engineer," he lied. "Want to be? Want to be? In my heart, I'm a computer engineer. It's only the brain that's letting me down." "Excuse me, could I know..." "Anathema device," said Anathema. "I'm an occultist, but that's just a hobby. I'm really a witch." "Well done. You're half an hour late," she added, handing him a small sheet of cardboard. "So you'd better read this. It'll save a lot of time." Newt did, in fact, own a small home computer, despite his boyhood experiences. In fact, he'd owned several. You always knew which ones he owned. They were desktop equivalents of the Wasabi. They were the ones which, for example, dropped to half price just after he'd bought them, or were launched in a blaze of publicity and disappeared into obscurity within a year, or only worked at all if you stuck them in a fridge, or if by some fluke they were basically good machines. Newt always got the few that were sold with the early bug-infested version of the operating system. But he persevered because he believed. Adam also had a small computer. He used it for playing games, but never for very long. He'd load a game, watch it intently for a few minutes, and then proceed to play it until the high score counter ran out of zeros. When the other them wondered about this strange skill, Adam professed mild amazement that everyone didn't play games like this. "All you have to do is learn how to play it, and then it's just easy," he said. Quite a lot of the front parlor in Jasmine Cottage was taken up, Newt noticed with a sinking feeling, with piles of newspapers. Clippings were stuck around the walls. Some of them had bits circled in red ink. He was mildly gratified to spot several he had cut out for Shadwell. Anathema owned very little in the way of furniture. The only thing she'd bothered to bring with her had been her clock, one of the family heirlooms. It wasn't a full-cased grandfather clock, but a wall clock with a free-swinging pendulum that E.A. Poe would cheerfully have strapped someone under. Newt kept finding his eye drawn to it. "It was built by an ancestor of mine," said Anathema, putting the coffee cups down on the table. "Sir Joshua Device. You may have heard of him? He invented the little rocking thing that made it possible to build accurate clocks cheaply. They named it after him." "The Joshua?" said Newt guardedly. "The device." In the last half hour, Newt had heard some pretty unbelievable stuff and was close to believing it, but you have to draw the line somewhere. "The device is named after a real person," he said. "Oh, yes. Fine old Lancashire name. From the French, I believe." "You'll be telling me next you've never heard of Sir Humphrey Gadget." "Oh, now come on. Who devised a gadget that made it possible to pump out flooded mine shafts?" "Or Peter Gizmo?"
Or Cyrus T. Doodad, America's foremost black inventor? Thomas Edison said that the only other contemporary practical scientists he admired were Cyrus T. Doodad and Ella Reader Widget. And she looked at Newt's blank expression. I did my Ph.D. on them, she said. The people who invented things so simple and universally useful that everyone forgot that they'd ever actually needed to be invented. Sugar? You normally have two, said Anathema sweetly. Newt stared back at the card she'd handed him. She'd seemed to think it would explain everything. It didn't. It had a ruled line down the middle. On the left-hand side was a short piece of what seemed to be poetry, in black ink. On the right-hand side, in red ink this time, were comments and annotations. Note, to help separate the text from the notes, all annotations will be preceded by the word comment. End note. The effect was as follows. Number 3819. When Orion's chariot inverted be, four wheels in the sky. Comment. Japanese car? Upturned. Car smash. A man with bruises. Comment. Not serious injury? Be upon your bed. Comment. Take in. Aching his head for Willowfine. Comment. Willowfine equal aspirin. Compare 3,757. A man who testeth with a pin. Comment. Pin equal witch finder. Compare 102. Yet his heart be clean. Comment. Good witch finder? Refers to Pulsifer. Compare 002. Yet seed of mine own undoing, take the means of flame from him for to make right certain. Comment. Search for matches, etc. In the 1990s. Together ye shall be. Comment. Until the end that is to come. Comment. Less than a day. Compare 712, 3803, 4004. Newt's hand went automatically to his pocket. His cigarette lighter had gone. What's this mean? He said hoarsely. Have you ever heard of Agnes Nutter? Said Anathema. No, said Newt, taking a desperate defense in sarcasm. You're going to tell me she invented mad people, I suppose. Another fine old Lancashire name, said Anathema coldly. If you don't believe, read up on the witch trials of the early 17th century. She was an ancestress of mine. As a matter of fact, one of your ancestors burned her alive. Or tried to. Newt listened in fascinated horror to the story of Agnes Nutter's death. Thou shalt not commit adultery, Pulsifer, he said when she'd finished. That sort of name was quite common in those days, said Anathema. Apparently there were 10 children, and they were a very religious family. There was covetousness, Pulsifer, false witness, Pulsifer. I think I understand, said Newt. Gosh, I thought Shadwell said he'd heard the name before. It must be in the Army records. I suppose if I'd gone around being called adultery Pulsifer, I'd want to hurt as many people as possible. I think he just didn't like women very much.
thanks for taking it so well, said Newt. I mean, he must have been an ancestor. There aren't many Pulsifers. Maybe that's why I sort of met up with the Witchfinder army. Could be fate, he said hopefully.
She shook her head. No, she said, no such thing.
Anyway, witch-finding isn't like it was in those days. I don't even think old Shadwell's ever done more than kick over Doris Stokes's dustbins.
Between you and me, Agnes was a bit of a difficult character, said Anathema vaguely. She had no middle gears.
Newt waved the bit of paper.
But what's it got to do with this? He said.
She wrote it. Well, the original. It's number 3819 of the Nice and Accurate Prophecies of Agnes Nutter, first published 1655.
Newt stared at the prophecy again. His mouth opened and shut.
She knew I'd crash my car, he said.
Yes, no, probably not. It's hard to say. You see, Agnes was the worst prophet that's ever existed, because she was always right. That's why the book never sold.
Most psychic abilities are caused by a simple lack of temporal focus, and the mind of Agnes Nutter was so far adrift in time that she was considered pretty mad even by the standards of 17th century Lancashire, where mad prophetesses were a growth industry. But she was a treat to listen to, everyone agreed. She used to go on about curing illnesses by using a sort of mold, and the importance of washing your hands so that the tiny little animals who cause diseases would be washed away, when every sensible person knew that a good stink was the only defense against the demons of ill health. She advocated running at a sort of gentle bouncing trot as an aid to living longer, which was extremely suspicious and first put the witch-finders onto her, and stressed the importance of fiber in diet, although here she was clearly ahead of her time, since most people were less bothered about the fiber in their diet than the gravel. And she wouldn't cure warts.
It is all in your mind, she'd say. Forget about it, and it will go away.
It was obvious that Agnes had a line to the future, but it was an unusually narrow and specific line. In other words, almost totally useless.
How do you mean, said Newt?
She managed to come up with the kind of predictions that you can only understand after the thing has happened, said Anathema.
Like, do not buy Betamax.
That was a prediction for 1972.
You mean she predicted videotape recorders?
No. She just picked up one little fragment of information, said Anathema. That's the point. Most of the time she comes up with such an oblique reference that you can't work it out until it's gone past. And then it all slots into place. And she didn't know what was going to be important or not. So it's all a bit hit and miss. Her prediction for November 22, 1963, was about a house falling down in King's Lynn.
Oh?
Newt looked politely blank.
President Kennedy was assassinated, said Anathema helpfully. But Dallas didn't exist then, you see, whereas King's Lynn was quite important.
Oh. She was generally very good if her descendants were involved.
Oh?
And she wouldn't know anything about the internal combustion engine. To her, they were just funny chariots. Even my mother thought it referred to an emperor's carriage overturning. You see, it's not enough to know what the future is. You have to know what it means. Agnes was like someone looking at a huge picture down a tiny little tube.
She wrote down what seemed like good advice, based on what she understood of the tiny little glimpses. "Sometimes you can be lucky," Anathema went on. "My great-grandfather worked out about the stock market crash of 1929, for example, 2 days before it actually happened. Made a fortune. You could say we're professional descendants." She looked sharply at Newt. "You see, what no one ever realized until about 200 years ago, that the nice and accurate prophecies was Agnes's idea of a family heirloom. Many of the prophecies relate to her descendants and their well-being. She was sort of trying to look after us after she'd gone. That's the reason for the King's Lynn prophecy, we think. My father was visiting there at the time. So from Agnes's point of view, while he was unlikely to be struck by stray rounds from Dallas, there was a good chance he might be hit by a brick." "What a nice person," said Newt. "You could almost overlook her blowing up an entire village." Anathema ignored this. "Anyway, that's about it," she said. "Ever since then, we've made it our job to interpret them. After all, it averages out at about one prophecy a month. More now, in fact, as we get closer to the end of the world." "And when is that going to be?" said Newt. Anathema looked meaningfully at the clock. He gave a horrible little laugh that he hoped sounded suave and worldly. After the events so far today, he wasn't feeling very sane. And he could smell Anathema's perfume, which made him uncomfortable. "Think yourself lucky I don't need a stopwatch," said Anathema. "We've got, about 5 or 6 hours.